ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Jeff Simmons for the next couple hours. Lots to get to, including the surprising Maple Leafs as of late. NFL season well past the midway point, and the Raptors another victory against a Western Conference opponent. But gents, we figured it would be a real interesting offseason for the Toronto Blue Jays, the deadline coming and going for players to take qualifying offers. And we did finally see, for the first time in the history of the qualifying offer in Major League Baseball, a couple of players taking one. Marco Estrada not one, though, as he was able to figure out a two-year deal to return to the place in which he had the best year of his career, returning to the Toronto Blue Jays. Two-year deal worth $26 million. So here we go. There's still some holes in the pitching staff as a whole, rotation and bullpen, but now you've got three real sturdy pieces, of course, with the caveat of health, in R.A. Dickey, Marcus Stroman, and now Marco Estrada returning to the rotation. And Jeff, yeah, there's still that leaves two more spots, and who knows where Drew Hutchison fits in there, but I guess it's a nice little start to this offseason.
Yeah, it really stabilizes the rotation, at least heading into free agency a little bit. And they had so many holes in that rotation after the year. And to bring back Estrada really helps you move forward. It limits what you need. And if you need to buy three free agent starters, that really puts you in a position of weakness. So to really get Estrada back at an ideal term, 2 years is perfect coming off a career year. And
nothing better than 2 years for Estrada, I think.
Yeah, that was a real win for the Blue Jays. And the money's not terrible. It's pretty fair given how good he was this year, and it's not going to hurt you going forward in terms of other moves. So I think it's a really good move to start the Blue Jays in motion, where they really got to rebuild the staff.
Yeah, that as I mentioned, it's not done by a long shot, and who knows where Drew Hutchison fits in, and whether Aaron Sanchez or Roberto Osuna, or Aaron Sanchez and Roberto Osuna, are given a shot to crack this rotation. But there's still work to be done here, John. What's the best way to go about continuing this process of building a starting rotation?
Well, I think every Jays fan would, you know, love to see one of the big names land here, because, you know, as good as Marcus Stroman was, he is not yet a major league ace, right? I mean, he
could be, though.
And I take nothing away from his performance this year, but he hasn't pitched a lot of innings. We haven't seen a full season from Marcus Stroman as a starter. He still has to prove that he can perform like that over an extended period of time, right? So, I mean, obviously everybody would be jumping for joy if Price resigns or Greinke lands here or, you know, Zimmerman signs on. But I think there's a lot of work to be done with that rotation. I think the only guy right now that you can really count on for 200 innings is R.A. Dickey. And, you know, as much as I like the Estrada deal, he could easily go back to being the guy who gives up the most home runs in the major leagues. I mean, considering the park, the home park he's pitching in and his past history, that's not out of the question.
And the peripheral numbers.
Of course, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to still figure out with this rotation. And you're, as it is right now, you're riding on hope for guys like Stroman and Sanchez if they move him back. Hutchison, can he bounce back? That's a lot of question marks, I think.
And Shai Davidi with a great story on Sportsnet.ca talking about how this Blue Jays team goes about adding pitching depth. And it's either through free agency where they pay big bucks, or it's through a big trade because everybody wants it. There's no higher level minor league pitcher that's ready to emerge. Like there's no Marcus Stroman of 2016 banging on the door who's 22, who's ready to step into a starting spot. Now, maybe Connor Green will be that guy in 2017. He's a guy that's kind of jumped onto everybody's radar, even though we'd never heard of him a couple of months ago. Some people still haven't heard of him. It's a situation, though, as well, that everybody's looking for starting pitching, wouldn't it make just the most sense to go out and get one of those guys through free agency? And I know everybody's going to be on top of David Price and Zach Greinke, but maybe you're looking at one of the lesser lights of that group. And you mentioned a Jordan Zimmermann. Is he going to cost the $200 million that David Price is going to garner on the free agent market? Is it $100 million? Is that an investment worth making?
I would like to see this team continue the trend that started under Alex Anthopoulos of trying to find guys and make creative moves to get guys who are younger and under control. Instead of having to sign David Price, for instance, to a 10-year, $280 million deal, and you end up with a 36-year-old Price in a, you know, down the road who's lost 3 or 4 miles an hour off of his fastball, and you're still saddled with that deal. I think for a team that has to play under a budget, you can't do those things. Now, can you make a trade from your position of strength, which is offense, on the current Major League roster, and find...
You just want to trade away Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. You've got your finger hovering over the button.
I think Jose Bautista, what happened to him this season could not have happened to a more deserving Blue Jay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to trade Jose Bautista. I just don't know that there's anybody on this roster who can get you the value back unless you trade Troy Tulowitzki. And we don't know if Tulo is happy here, but I would rather trade a 36-year-old right fielder with declining defensive abilities than Tulowitzki at shortstop, who is a gold glover and a silver slugger.
But that's the issue, isn't it? If you got a 36-year-old with declining defensive abilities with 1 year left, what are you getting back for him?
Yeah.
Well, if you can get some bullpen depth and just kind of restock the cupboard a little bit and then go spend some money on a guy like Chris Davis and get that left-handed masher to play first base for you to replace that those 40 home runs and 100 RBI, maybe you're better off.
Doesn't that Chris Davis thing seem like a tailor-made Alex Anthopoulos move where this team seems totally set offensively, not unlike the Troy Tulowitzki deal in which, what's this team going out and trading for a shortstop? What's this team going out and signing a masher like Chris Davis to add to a lineup that's already stacked? This lineup would be literally impossible to pitch to. There would be no holes whatsoever in this lineup. You go out and get Chris Davis to be that left-handed masher in the middle of this lineup playing first base every day. Like, that would be ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, the thing about the Tulo trade, it was as much about defense as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the Jays, with Jose Reyes at shortstop, they had to make as many as 3 more outs per game because of the, you know, not because of errors necessarily, but a lack of range and all that stuff. And Tulo, you know, the whole dynamic of this team changed on the defensive side of things when he hit the scene. And offense is offense, and we all know that that's what the Jays are best at, and you can't have too much of it, especially when your pitching staff is pretty questionable and your bullpen depth is non-existent, more or less. So, yes, go out and make those moves. Add to what you can.
Well, just reading the tea leaves and understanding the things that are being reported by Shai Davidi and Ben Nicholson-Smith and Mike Wilner, who were down at the GM meetings, I get a sense that this team and Tony LaCava is not intent on taking away from this offense to fill a hole in the rotation or in the bullpen as far as trading away pieces that are currently part of their starting nine on the major league roster. Now, what does that mean? How do you figure out a deal for a starting pitcher if you're not taking away from this offense, Jeff? I mean, there's maybe a group of left fielders that aren't going to play a big part of this team going forward in 2016 because you got a decision to make on Ben Revere, Michael Saunders. Maybe you can non-tender and then figure out a contract for him to return, and Dalton Pompey. Other than that, if you're not trading off the major league roster, are you looking at trading away prospects again?
And that's where this team's in a bit of a tricky spot. They gave up all those pitchers and those deals from last year, so there's a hole in their system there. So I think, and it's very much sounds like it from the reporters you mentioned, that they're going to be a little more involved in free agency for pitchers that they have been in the past. And they really haven't been under Anthopoulos' regime and even Ricciardi's regime.
It's like Toma Oka.
Yeah, Toma Oka. Remember John Thompson?
Yeah. Did he throw a pitch for the Blue Jays?
I don't think so. And I think they're going to try to get they could be in on the Zimmerman type. And maybe Mike Leake was a guy that Anthopoulos and this regime tried to trade for before the price stuff happened. That could be a guy they look at too. And maybe they'll try to buy low on some guys. You saw how good Chris Young was for the Royals this year. They're going to need to fill 2 to 3 slots unless you're comfortable with Hutchison right now.
Do you think Edison Volquez could come into this clubhouse and survive?
Yeah. I don't know. It's amazing how winning and how quickly guys get over stuff. Like Darren O'Day, I think, would. I know him and Jose Bautista have had their issues, but I guarantee you, if the Blue Jays go sign Darren O'Day tomorrow, they're on a conference call between the two, and maybe there's a mediator between Bautista and O'Day, but.
You don't have to sit them beside each other in the clubhouse, right?
Right, yeah. Because if you start going down that road, there's a lot of guys that would be excluded from this Blue Jays clubhouse. Johnny Cueto. There's a lot of guys that have made mortal enemies.
Basically every Kansas City Royal who's currently a free agent, right?
Essentially.
And I guess, you know, as you were saying, Ben, they have to be involved in pitching free agency because they don't have any more prospects to trade, right? I mean, you mentioned Green, who's a few years away, and you know better than me. Like who
John
else do
Reed,
they have?
Foley, like there's a bunch of guys that we'll start to hear about in the coming days, right? And you know, and part of this is PR as well. And you'll see every GM around Major League Baseball do it. But Tony LaCava did come out and say, I think our minor league system's underrated. I think it's still pretty good.
Who's going to say they have a bad minor league
right.
system?
Right. No, our minor league system needs some work. Shouldn't trade for any of these guys. They're lousy. They're not going to be anything. But there's always guys that do emerge. They just don't have those guys that are knocking on the door that are real close. Like Jeff Hoffman would have been a real option going into opening day this year, whether it's in the bullpen or in the rotation. Now, he's gone. So it's not an option anymore, obviously. So those guys don't exist in the minor leagues for the Toronto Blue Jays. But we mentioned the free agent market for starting pitching. Not only is it going to cost you a bunch, but there's like these new players interested in starters. Like when was the last time the St. Louis Cardinals were one of those teams that was really ready to pony up some big bucks, but they have a hole in the starting rotation. Apparently they're going to be in on one of the big guys. We already know the Red Sox are going to be in on one of the big guys. Dave Dombrowski pretty much said they're going to sign us a free agent starter. Yankees, everybody.
Do we even want the Jays to be in on the big guys? That's my question for the two of you. Do you think it's worth spending all that money and spending all that term on the top of the rotation guy when maybe you could get two for kind of the same dollars and see what you get out of them?
It's easy to say no, right? Like, it's easy to say, hey, where's the 7-year deal that's worked out? And you can count them on one hand. You only need, like, you need Jason Pierre-Paul's hand to count them. It's not a situation that ends up looking real good 3 to 4 years down the line. But that being said, remember, this Blue Jays offense was intact pretty much all season. It was a juggernaut all season long. They were still pretty rancid early in the year because they had a horrible pitching staff, had a horrible bullpen. And how many games were blown late? And how many games were they down 6-0 after 5 innings, right? Like that, you still need serviceable starting pitching.
I'm not suggesting you don't get serviceable starting pitching or find or load up for spring training in the bullpen and hope that you come away with, you know, a few more guys who can do the job for you in the right situations.
But sometimes hoping for serviceable, you get less than serviceable. Because that's all they were hoping for last year and beginning of the season. They didn't even get that. They were 50-51.
So then you're thinking, Ben, that they should go out and do everything they can to get one of those big names for the top of the rotation.
I'm just saying and clearly they're not the Dodgers. They're not working with monopoly money. If you did, it would be a no-brainer to go out and get those guys. I'm saying, and I know Mark Shapiro has been pretty upfront in saying, hey, we want to do both things, and we are certainly in win-now mode, clearly, as we were 2 games away from winning the World Series. But we got to be two minds here in that we're trying to add to the Major League roster, but we're also trying to replenish the coffers as far as our minor league system and our young players. I don't know if you can do both. It really seems like you can't. And if you want to win, and if your window's 2-3 years, because even if you lose Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista, which I'm not sure that they are, I feel like maybe we'll see an extension this offseason for one, if not both of those guys, that you got to deal away some more minor leaguers. And I know it hurts, but by the time Connor Green's ready to emerge at the major league level, it's going to be a different window. You just hope to draft well, I guess. It does seem like that's not the modus operandi of Mark Shapiro, though, Jeff.
I would be very surprised if they start dealing away more prospects based on what we know about how Shapiro's built organizations in the past and the reports that come out about his feelings on the Price trade and how he treated Anthopoulos about that.
But isn't that scary? So how do you do it? What do you do?
At this point, I think the draft is really your only avenue, and you got to start – you got to live with what you have, and you got to move forward. I don't think taking away from the major league club is the best approach right now.
But, when Jeff, what if you take away from the major league club to try and restock the cupboard a little bit and then go out in free agency and fill the holes? Like, if you traded Jose Bautista and then went out and got Jason Hayward, is that so bad?
What happens if you don't get Hayward?
Well, you got to give him enough money where he can't say no.
But then how do you fix your pitching holes? That's the issue.
Well, the same way, I guess. I mean, everybody wants pitching, Ben. As you've said before, I mean, everybody is going to be in on all the top names. You know, all you can do is hope that you can either overpay somebody and find lightning in a bottle or get lucky with the Marco Estradas of the world, right?
Yeah, and they definitely did get lucky with Marco Estrada. He was a guy they kind of targeted, but he was the one guy the Brewers willing to give up for Adam Lind, and it ended up completely having an incredible season with the Toronto Blue Jays, totally knocking down his home run totals. All right, what about those two guys, the two young guys in the bullpen that I mentioned, Aaron Sanchez and Roberto Osuna? Because it's certainly an Osuna. He's a guy I can see at one point in his career getting a shot as a starter, because he's been a starter his entire career, and he's got the arsenal of pitches to be a real good starting pitcher. I don't know how I feel about Sanchez, if it's the same way, but if we're looking at one, if not both of those guys, at least getting a shot to land a starting spot going into day one of the regular season next year, what kind of innings are we expecting out of, first, a guy who's just a couple of years removed from Tommy John surgery, or an Aaron Sanchez who's battled injuries even last year, right? Like, that's, maybe people forget that he started the season as a starter, maybe couldn't hack it. Maybe it's one of these guys who can never stay healthy as a starter, and maybe he's a guy who can't get lefties out. So should the Blue Jays be hanging their hats on either one of those guys to step into a starting role?
I think you got to try Sanchez. I think you stretch him out and see what you've got with him as a starter. I mean, unless you can go out and find somebody who can close out ball games for you, Roberto Osuna did a pretty damn good job of that last year, and I'm pretty happy with him and where he is, especially at his age.
Aren't you creating another hole, though, if you move him out of the bullpen? Like, how many reliable bullpen arms do you have now if Roberto Osuna's not there?
I would keep both of them in the bullpen. And I know both these guys probably project down the road as starters, and I get the idea of why the Blue Jays might want to use these high upside guys, but then you're creating a huge hole, and they're already paper thin in the bullpen. If Mark Lowe doesn't re-sign, they could barely get through that last series when Cecil went down. And you have those three relievers, and then what else? So this is one of your positions of strength. I would leave it at that and try to add on top of it and then fix the rotation, because these guys are unknowns in the rotation, and this is a good 8-9, and you see the Royals and you see some of these teams, you really need that. And to have that take away and create another hole, I think that's a very dangerous move.
But regardless, are you stretching them out over the winter to see?
Sure. I mean, there's always, you can always go backwards that way. Is it's way more difficult to have them start spring training as relievers and then stretch them out, because, I mean, you need almost a month to do that. What about a guy like Aroldis Chapman? Because there are relievers available on the trade market, and we already saw the Red Sox land Craig Kimbrell for nobody that was on their major league roster. Now, pretty good prospects, and the Red Sox had one of these great minor league systems that maybe the Blue Jays had at one point, and is now scattered around Major League Baseball. They had to give up quite a bit if you buy into what the prospect people are telling you, and the shortstop they gave up in Guerra could be a real good one. Is that a guy, in talking about trading what little prospect capital you have left? I mean, you throw Aroldis Chapman into the bullpen, and you've got Osuna, and you've got Sanchez back there, and then maybe add another middle-of-the-road starter. Are we looking at something there?
Yeah. Who doesn't want Aroldis Chapman in your bullpen? But my thing is, I don't think Mark Shapiro is going to be trading prospects for major league players right now.
I just don't see any other way then.
That's why I keep going back to the major league roster as it is now. And, you know, moving desirable pieces for prospects or for depth in your bullpen, maybe a bottom, maybe number four starter for depth there, and then filling in those holes on the free agent market. And like I said, I do not want to see the end of Jose Bautista or Edwin Encarnacion or Troy Tulowitzki in this city.
He said before he came away with a comment about trading Jose Bautista.
No, I'm saying, what choice do you have? What are your options? You don't have any prospects to trade, and you don't have a lot of money to spend.
But how about trade a guy who's desirable and going to get a big return, too? Like, I'm with Jeff. I don't see the return for Jose Bautista. And this is a guy who hit third in the best offense in all of baseball last year.
I'm not knocking Jose's performance. Not at all. I'm just saying he's going to make $12 million this year.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a contender out there who needs 40 and 100 for $12 million. There's got to be.
On a one-year deal, though. We've seen teams understanding.
But we're sitting here talking about win now, win this year.
Right.
We're talking about having this guy on our team on a one-year deal.
Right.
Why wouldn't somebody else want him on that deal?
Well, you're talking about win now, and it seems counterintuitive and intuitive to talk about to creating a lineup that is good enough to replicate what it did last year, and maybe nothing can replicate what happened last year as far as the offense, and trading away the three-hole hitter. Just, it seems like you're creating a huge hole. As much as one guy can't carry an offense, although sometimes at times it seemed like Josh Donaldson was last year.
Who could be your number three hitter next year.
Sure, but then you're looking at whoever's playing right field. Is it Michael Saunders? Is it Dalton Pompey?
No,
like,
but
where's the drop off?
Yeah,
there?
I'm suggesting you go out and you fill that right field hole on the free agent market.
I don't know.
Right? You spend the money you have to lock a guy down for the next few years so that you're not only thinking when in this one final year that these guys are on these deals. It's no different than what Alex did with Troy Tulowitzki in what for the first couple years of Tulowitzki being around was a salary neutral deal, but he was thinking long term. He's thinking defense up the middle and a silver slugger bat over a longer period of time. And I think you need to be creative in this day and age. And I think that's one way that you can be creative is make a big deal and then go fill the holes in from other areas.
Imagine the PR nightmare after losing Anthopoulos and then trading Bautista.
It would be a complete nightmare. And I'm not suggesting
it wouldn't be. I'm just laughing at that.
And, you know, and I don't even know that it could be much worse for Shapiro anyway. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know what you do because, as we've all said, there's no prospects to trade.
And that's the issue. Depth has been a concern for this team for the last 2 years. And you saw at the deadline when they added Revere and added Lowe and when Hawkins was even – and he was important for a while before he faded off. But when they didn't have depth at the beginning of the year, they had that great run differential, but they couldn't hold up. Mm-hmm. And now they've kind of lost their depth again.
Yeah. And not a lot of teams have real good starting depth in the minor leagues. Like, there's not – a bunch of six starters ready to emerge for most teams.
But the bullpen, too.
Bullpen depth, yeah. And it's easy to forget because the baseball season's so long and they were so good for the last couple of months. But early in the season, it was a frustrating team to watch how good they were offensively and how many leads they frittered away.
They're wasting an all-time great offense.
They were 50-51
right
at the trade deadline. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Plus, the American League East isn't getting any worse, right?
No.
The Red Sox already second half of last season looked like they had turned it around, at least offensively. That
got
looked
a great
like a good
young
club
team over there.
Yeah, and they're going to add a starter. They've already added Craig Kimbrell. The Yankees have a full season of Luis Severino. They're talking about all kinds of crazy moves, like dealing away Brett Gardner, maybe Andrew Miller. Maybe they add a starter. Yeah, I think maybe the ship has sailed on both the Orioles and the Rays. But Red Sox and Yankees, like you're going to get a full season of a couple of teams with payrolls of $200 million. Again, the payroll thing, like, it's a lot easier to project this Blue Jays team for 2016 if we know exactly what the payroll is. And now the projections with Marco Estrada and the arbitration projections have this team at $115.5 million or so. And if the payroll is what it was last year, so $130 million, that means 15-ish left to spend. Now, we've heard conflicting reports from different people, so who knows what it is. I can't imagine it being reduced significantly unless they want people with pitchforks and torches outside.
And it's just bad business to do here.
What would be a worse PR nightmare? Trading Jose Bautista or reducing payroll?
Oh, I think reducing payroll, because Jose Bautista, at least there'll be something coming back in return, right? Like, and you exactly. would expect something good. And I know Shai has been pretty upfront in talking about this, that it's a hard scenario to envision the Blue Jays significantly reducing payroll after the year that was and all the good feelings about this Blue Jays team. But it's been a fun offseason so far, and the big names haven't even moved yet. There's a lot of dominoes still to fall. And, we don't have the ninja Alex Anthopoulos here, but we got Ninja Light, I don't know, his apprentice, Ninja Apprentice in Tony LaCava, who I'm sure has learned a few things working with Alex Anthopoulos over the last few years. When we come back, Raptors win again. That three-game losing streak a little bit in our rearview mirrors as they continue to have a nice little run against Western Conference opponents. They're 7-3. Damari Carroll returns, and they're a totally different club with him as they limit the Pelicans to just 81 points. They win at Air Canada Center Friday night, 100-81. We'll talk about them and what to make of Terrence Ross and his injury and where he fits into this team when he does return, if that happens at some point in the near future. Alongside John Gregg and Jeff Simmons, I'm Ben Ennis at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine, here's Jordan Heath Rawlings.
He takes the snap and he takes a five-step drop. Okay, wait, maybe it was six. He sees an open receiver. Well, a receiver he thinks is open anyway. And with a second or two left to go before the defense arrives, he lets the pass fly. Off his back foot, naturally. The ball climbs in the air, and fans of both teams hold their breath. Because this isn't a Pro Bowl QB hitting an open man in stride way downfield. This is a bad quarterback, trying to make something, anything happen. And who catches that ball is anyone's guess. The truly great quarterbacks get the awards, and the money, and the Super Bowls. But too often, we forget about the guys who can take an ordinary football game and make it into something special. The guys who are willing to give it a shot, even if that shot ends up going for a pick six the other way. Bad quarterbacks need love too. And yeah, the Tom Brady's of the world aren't going anywhere. We should make room in our hearts for the guys who give it their all, even when their all probably isn't good enough. After all, nobody wants to watch a pass smartly thrown out of bounds under pressure. Nobody wants to see people do the responsible thing. No, we're watching on Sunday to see the QB go deep and damn the consequences. We should salute the men who do just that.
Story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Jeff Simmons. Raptors win 181 against the Anthony Davis-less Pelicans on a Friday night. They're 7-3 now, 3-1 at home. Damari Carroll returns from his plantar fasciitis, which can be really painful. I've had it before. It's hard to even walk. I don't know how you play basketball with it, but apparently he was able to deal with it. Played 33 minutes on Friday. Didn't have a great first quarter. Didn't have a great offensive game overall. 5-14 for 11 points, but it seems like this team is totally different when he is in the starting five. That seems like a real hit 100%. In free agency for the Raptors.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, that was, you know, the best move they could have made maybe for this team. And I think all the moves they made in the offseason were built around defense first, which has always been Dwayne Casey's claim to fame, and which is something they didn't have last year, you know, when they had ball-stopping shooters and didn't really have the intensity that they needed in their own end of the floor. And, you know, this when Damari Carroll is playing, this looks like a team that can shut probably anybody except Golden State down. Maybe not LeBron James.
We'll get to see if they can shut down Golden State as they go out on the road on the West Coast. Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like that might be too much of a task to ask of anybody in the NBA right now. But this is a team, yeah, that's made its bones on defense this year, not unlike they did 2 years ago. The question about this team was going to be scoring and secondary scoring, which is still a question, Jeff. Is it becoming less of a question, especially if Patrick Patterson can start scoring a little bit? Like, how are they going to get a little bit of offense out of this second unit?
Patrick Patterson's going to be the one it's going to need. Last night, he had a couple big three-pointers. I mean, Friday night, he had some big three-pointers, and they don't have great bench scoring, but you can, when you have defense like that across your lineup, you can get by. I still think they're one of the top five scoring teams in the East right now, and their starting lineup can still produce a ton of offense, but if you look, they don't have that Lou Williams type of three-point shooter coming off the bench anymore. They've gone more defensive heavy the way Dwayne Casey likes to play, but I don't think they need that necessarily if you can hold teams down when you got Damari Carroll impacting the floor like that. It's just, it's not as important. You saw they scored in bunches last year, and they couldn't win against tougher teams, and they faded down the stretch in the playoffs. And I think you can always find that maybe in a trade later on, or, but right now the defense first thing is winning for them, and it's definitely working.
What's the hope for this team? Where are expectations? Where are goals? Because it's not a team that you think has a chance to win an NBA title. And the NBA is different than almost every other North American professional sport, where there's only a few teams that have a legit shot to win it all, and maybe 70% of them lie in the Western Conference. I don't know what the odds are on the Cleveland Cavaliers winning the East, but it would be shocking if it wasn't, 20-1 for anybody outside of Cleveland winning the Eastern Conference. So what is it, John? Is it, hey, finish fourth or fifth, win a round, and then get your clock cleaned in the second round?
It's home court advantage. Win a round, and then hit big in free agency next year, you know, and try and go out and get that guy who is the superstar and can add to this core and create the kind of team you mentioned would in this league.
How do you do that? And listen, that opens up the door to the DeMar DeRozan question, who will opt out of his deal, and you can't work out an extension until he does that this offseason. So there's no extension. Maybe there's extension talk, but you can't do it until the offseason and he opts out, which he clearly will, because he's making $9 million or $8 million, and Terrence Ross is making $11 million next season.
Yeah,
so
DeMar's going to be a max player.
Right. And on the surface, I don't know, I keep bouncing it around in my head. Do you want DeMar DeRozan as your best player, making your most money, and you expect to be an NBA title contender? Obviously not, but what choice do you have? You can't let him walk, and if you do let him walk or you trade him away, aren't you going into tank mode and hoping you get a lottery pick again, and then aren't you in this whole cycle? Can you hang your hat on hoping Andrew Wiggins is going to leave Minnesota via free agency and want to return home? Like, what's the long-term play for this Raptors team?
They're in a really tough spot. The good thing for them is, in terms of drafting, they have that pick that comes from either Denver or New York next year. If those two teams have terrible seasons, that could be a lottery pick and a really high pick, and there's a chance to get a star. But I think the DeRozan thing is the big question for them because, yeah, in this market, he deserves max money. But you probably can't win a title if he's your number 1A guy. And he may be an all-star, but he's not a superstar. And you the unfortunate part of the NBA is you need a superstar to win the championship. And as good as the Raptors have been the last 3 years since Masai took over, and they've been a good, likable team, but their ceiling is so limited, and it's kind of hard to get into them when you know winning one, maybe two rounds is their best-case scenario.
Maybe you can hope to be that Detroit Pistons style of defense that is just so smothering and didn't have a superstar and that just pounded teams into submission, but they're not that elite level defensive team.
Yeah, and I think that's a different era. I mean, I think we're all agreed that you need at least one, if not two, superstars on your team to win in today's NBA.
And DeRozan's not a superstar. Do we agree? I think he would be. Is there a question there?
I don't think he's not Kevin Durant.
Yeah. Right? I don't think he's a superstar.
You know, I think he'd be a great as your number two guy behind, you know, you've got a guy like Durant and then you've got DeRozan. Great. I mean, they similar players playing similar positions, but still, I mean, you know, that's what you need in this league. It's been proven time and time again. And yeah, the Raps don't have that right now, and they're not going to be bad enough to get anybody like that in the draft. So
it doesn't
it's
help.
An interesting time coming up for that team.
It doesn't help when you lose to the Knicks as well. When you're trying to make sure that the Knicks and the Nuggets end up as with as poor a record as they can possibly have, and at least on the outside of the playoff picture looking in, so they have a chance at moving up in the NBA draft lottery. But yeah, you don't necessarily need the first or second overall pick because we see what's gone on in Golden State with the Warriors.
They have a first overall pick, Anthony Bennett.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. They absolutely do. Who's now seeing some time. He played 2 minutes on Friday. Was a minus two. Did have a rebound, though. But are the Warriors maybe that beacon in the wilderness that you can say, hey, you know, it didn't look like they were built around a superstar. They didn't go grab one in free agency. Now, one kind of landed in their lap mid-first round with Steph Curry. And I guess, do you just have to get lucky in the draft? Like, how did the Raptors take the leap from being just one of the also-rans in the Eastern Conference, a nice little team that can maybe look good at times, but no real hope of winning a title? Like, how do you make that leap without drafting super high? Is the Warriors model one where you just, you know, you have to hope that you're smarter than everybody else around 6, 7, 8 in the draft?
That's a tough scenario because there just aren't that many Steph Currys going 8th overall, and hoping that happens is a very dangerous approach. And the Raptors were kind of built like Indiana was a couple years ago. They were a good, tough team in a thin Eastern Conference. They were well-built. They were deep. But they've kind of faded away as they never really had that superstar. Paul George is a pretty good player, and
Roy Hibbert had like a moment.
Roy Hibbert having a moment, and once they kind of faded, and as Grig indicated before, I think this is a big free agency. They got Drake, and they got the All-Star game, and I think they're gonna have to start hoping maybe you can land one of those big guys. And Durant is hitting the market, and he was a Raptor fan growing up. I don't know
so
if that matters.
You're hanging your hat on Kevin
Durant.
I'm not
hanging my hat on that. I'm saying if that's how you get, that is one way you get to the next level.
Yeah. That would be a nice little add. Okay, so maybe DeMar DeRozan's not a superstar. Are we kind of overlooking the potential of Jonas Valanciunas being a superstar? Because he's a big man who, you look at the numbers, you look at the efficiency under the bucket, the rebounding, his age, he's 23, right? Like 22, 23. He's still growing. He's learning every season, it seems like, improving every season. He's taking more of those jump shots that are in his range because he's a pretty good jump shooter, and they're going to have to start respecting that, which is going to leave teams vulnerable to the pump fake, which he's done his entire career, that has kind of been a bugaboo of mine because he never takes those jumpers. Now he's taken them, and he made a bunch, at least in the first quarter against the Pelicans on Friday. Is that the guy that we should be looking at instead of how guard-heavy this Raptors team is as far as creating offense? Doesn't it make more sense to start thinking about building around a big man in Jonas Valanciunas?
I think he's as important to the future, the present and the future of this team as anybody else. I mean, he's got the highest PER on the team. He's a 15-10 guy right now. And as you alluded to, Ben, he's adding elements to his game that he hasn't had in the past. It reminds me a little bit of the way Chris Bosh, when he was in Toronto, every year it seemed like he could step a few feet further away from the basket and hit shots. And
now he's just hitting three-pointers.
Yes, and it opened up his game. And although I wouldn't call him a superstar, I mean, he is a very good basketball player with a lot of elements. And, you know, Jonas seems like he's bigger, kind of thicker body than that. And I think he's gonna always be more of a post guy and your classic kind of big-bodied center.
Yeah.
But he's making a lot of strides, like especially over the past, you know, 12 months.
I think I take 8 of 11, 20 points and 10 boards. He's a seemingly a double-double every night. Like that, you can pretty much pencil him in for a double-double. And it would be kind of nice to see, hey, DeMar DeRozan an all-star, Kyle Lowry an all-star the next year, and Jonas Valanciunas maybe an all-star in year number 3. It seems like, Jeff, that the Raptors and especially the guards are looking for him a little bit more offensively too, which has been frustrating for Raptors fans in years previous that, you know, they're looking for him to get a few more offensive touches. And it looks, at least peripherally, like they are trying to do that. And he's seeing more time in the fourth quarter, which I guess makes sense when you don't really have an offensive replacement for him on the bench because Bismack Biyombo gives you a lot of defense, but nothing offensively.
Yeah, he's been double-digit scoring in every game but one this year, and the fourth quarter has been huge because that was such a big talking point of the Raptors, and it was such a point of frustration for fans from Jordan Casey's perspective. And you see how valuable, and he's only 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is really taking a natural progression, and last year he
takes big men longer too.
Yeah, and he didn't take that step that everyone thought after his rookie season. He kind of had that sophomore. He had to adjust a bit. He struggled, and the coach was not comfortable playing him, but if this guy can develop, that really gives you a big piece going forward. And he's probably the guy you're more comfortable with. And you got him for a pretty cheap rate, too. They signed him to that deal, which is a lot better than that Terrence Ross deal. But Valanciunas, he's only going to get better with time. And he's really taken that step. And if you can get double-double out of him almost every night, that's a part of their game that they really haven't had because they don't have that great power forward beside him. Scola's a solid veteran, but to get that presence down the middle, that's big for them.
And now he's a little more aerodynamic with the shaved head. When we return, Maple Leafs are actually playing some half-decent hockey right now, taking it to the Dallas Stars and the Nashville Predators. What does that mean for the future? And does it, you know, does it reflect real nicely on Mike Babcock? I tend to think so. What do they do in goal as well? Because James Reimer has kind of taken the reins and run with it with Jonathan Bernier set to return from his injury. Also, we'll have a look at how to break out of this scoring drought in the NHL and if it involves reducing the size of goalie equipment. All that and more coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and John Gregg. It's the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Live Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside John Gregg and Jeff Simmons. Maple Leafs are not as rancid as they were earlier this season. Still dead last in the Atlantic Division, but second last is within sight, sort of, kind of. 3 points back of the Florida Panthers, who have 15 points. Maple Leafs with 12 points. They're no longer dead last in the Eastern Conference, passing the Columbus Blue Jackets. And they even have a game in hand on Columbus. How bad is Columbus? Thank goodness.
Columbus is above 500. Remember, they started the year 0-8,
yeah,
right?
No, how bad was that? So maybe the John Tortorella effect still in the process of taking place. But the Maple Leafs, now they've been a much better possession team all season long, even when they were losing. They've had real good efforts, specifically against the Montreal Canadiens. Even game one of the regular season, real good. Loss in Montreal, good effort, and they were Carey Priced out of that one. They've shown glimpses at times. We know it's not a good hockey team, but early in the Mike Babcock tenure, it's hard not to be impressed.
Yeah, you see how good of a coach he is, just how different they play, how tough they are. And how many teams in the league have less skill than they do? And they're still playing. This is going perfect for them. They're establishing this tough brand of how Babcock wants to play. Their possession numbers are way up from the past regimes. And they're not winning that many games. And they're in position to get a high draft pick. Things cannot be going better for them right now.
So boring to watch, though. Like, oh, man, I just can't watch a Leafs game because, yes, they're playing a better system, and that's kudos to the new coach, and it really does show what one of the best coaches in the world can do for even a horrendously skilled hockey team. But I mean, it's like death. Like, I'm going to the Avalanche game this week. I don't know if I want to go, right? Except unless I can see Matt Duchene, who maybe could one day be a Toronto Maple Leaf.
And you got free tickets, I'm sure.
I might have.
Yeah.
I might have.
Okay. Right. So maybe it's boring, and maybe the style of play is boring. Is that just the result of the system? Is it the result of, you know, even with all this puck possession, the chance on goal is not going to result in a goal because there's not enough skill there?
Yes, it's a better system, but they are a less skilled team than they were last year even. I mean, their only game breaker is now playing for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And Phil Kessel was one of the few reasons that anybody would want to show up to watch hockey at the Air Canada Center, and at least in one end of the ice. So, yeah, I mean, it's the system would work better if they had better players.
Should we not, though? I mean, what do you make of the fact that they've taken consecutive points against the Red Wings, who might not be that great, but in Washington, took them to a shootout and lost. They beat the Stars for now the second time this season in Dallas, and then just beat the Predators in a shootout in Nashville. What do we make of that? Because I know this team isn't good, and I know they've hung in there pretty much. They have not been blown out, save for maybe the one game in Detroit where maybe the effort was not the greatest. They've been in almost every game. They've looked half decent and capable at times. They're not getting outshot 50-20 anymore. And here they are in four straight games against some pretty good teams, coming away with points, and in the last two points against really good teams. Like, what should I make of that? Is this team better than maybe we thought? Or is this just, hey, even a blind squirrel finding the occasional nut? Like, what's happening here?
Listen, they're a hardworking team. There's no doubt about it. You know, there's a bunch of guys on that team who are being given new responsibilities by the coaching staff and are doing their best to prove themselves to a coach who's working on an 8-year deal. You know, maybe people are taking them a little bit too lightly. You know, I mean, you roll in on a road trip and you roll into Dallas and Nashville
and
Washington.
The Stars are taking them lightly after they lost at the Air Canada Center. Can you?
They're 12-4 or whatever they were when the Leafs came into town. So, I mean, the Stars are probably looking past Toronto as saying, okay, here's 2 points. Who's next? That happens in sports, right? I mean, you start looking at the schedule.
So you don't want to give them any credit whatsoever?
No, I give them all the credit in the world for what they are, a really bad hockey team with a great coach, and they're playing to what he wants them to do. And that's the credit is deserved for that. But there's not a lot of people you want to go watch play on this squad.
Listen, you're Dr. Professor PDO, right? Like, you love your PDO. You've got it tattooed on your neck. You love PDO. Where's their PDO? It's rancid, right? Like, they have lots of shots that don't go to the back of the net, and the goaltending, for the most part, has been horrible this year.
Their PDO right now at even strength is 99.5. And, you know, the mean is 100. So it's not like they're getting super unlucky. They're just not generating the scoring chances that you need.
That's what happens when you don't have talent.
Exactly. Doesn't matter what system you're playing if you can't generate the offense that you need within that system, right, Jeff?
Yeah, they're not your traditional bad team where there's some fun young guys to watch. They have maybe, what, two or three of them? There's Morgan Riley, who looks like an outstanding young player. There's Kadri, who has had the worst luck maybe of any player in the NHL this year. And how much more is there beyond that? Jake Gardner?
Yeah, I think we're over him,
yeah,
right?
I think we know what he is. He's a highly talented player that makes weird turnovers and not the smartest player, but outside of that, all their exciting players are in the AHL level. They're trying to build through the draft, and there's not a lot of reasons to watch them. But in terms of progress from a front office perspective or a educated fan perspective, this is what you want to see.
From the top down, there's been progress. I mean, it's an organization that is now being run with a singular end result in mind, and everybody is playing to that end result, and that's good to see. That bodes really well for the future. But for the present, they are what they are.
Yeah, it's ugly.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of reasons to watch.
But that being said, watch them every time they're on Sportsnet either way, because you just do it. Just,
yeah, for the other team.
Just shut up.
Or go get your game center and watch another team instead.
Oh, yeah, I'm all over it. You know what? You know what's $1 million idea? Although maybe not $1 million. I don't know how you monetize it. But a Twitter account that alerts you to every 3-on-3 overtime that takes place. Because I'll be, you know, on Twitter and someone will say, hey, 3-on-3 overtime. Like yesterday, the Calgary Flames, Friday, the Calgary Flames playing a little 3-on-3. Flip that one on. And of course, the game's going to be over in just over a minute, unless the Ottawa Senators are playing in it, because they're like the only team that's playing for the shootout, seemingly, in this 3-on-3. Okay, before we move on from the Maple Leafs, because, yeah, there's not a whole lot to talk about when it comes to that team. Although I think they're slightly better than people initially thought they were, and that their record suggested they were early this season.
Yes, they are a better team than people, you know, they're not cratering out yet.
And I'm looking at a
third
PDO.
Last overall.
I'm looking at their PDO. I don't know where you're looking at. I got their PDO, and maybe this isn't 5-on-5 PDO, but I got their PDO as being 25th in the NHL. So maybe that's just overall PDO. We were looking at different PDOs. We'll consolidate our PDOs in the break here. But, yeah, they're not a great hockey team, obviously. And I think it's incredible what Mike Babcock has them doing with such a limited group. And so much of the early season struggles, I think you can put on goaltending, partly, and shooting percentage being rather low. That's probably going to regress to a little bit better than it is. So Jonathan Bernier goes down with his injury. And Bernier, I believe, still only has one of this team's points this year. James Reimer responsible for every single win and has made some spectacular saves. He's also allowed the occasional soft goal. Why does it feel like he's the guy that always gets the least amount of credit, that he's the like backup plan to the backup plan, but every time he gets a shot, he performs rather admirably? I'm okay with him getting the lion's share of starts here, even when Jonathan Bernier returns.
Yeah, he's earning it. And Mike Babcock likes to roll with a pure number one goalie, not like Carlisle, who would go back and forth based on whoever played the last game and however they played. And Reimer's looked a hell of a lot better than Bernier. And at this point, why not give him the chance? He's exactly the kind of goalie you want in a team like this. See what he's made of, and he's cheap against the cap, and he's a likable guy, and kind of an underdog story. But every time Bernier gets that chance, he kind of takes a step back. He's a hard guy to believe in right now.
Right, he is. And both have the bugaboo of allowing the occasional weak goal. And I don't know how you erase that, but
which do you prefer, though, the goalie who loses you games or the goalie who wins you games?
Yeah.
And really, are you,
is it that simple?
Well, it might be. It depends on what you want to see out of this team this season, and really, are you hoping that maybe one of them is actually really good and then you can trade him? Like,
I don't know. I don't know who is in position to contend. That's like in the market for a Jonathan Bernier or a James Reimer.
What
type.
If you're the Buffalo Sabres and you need somebody who's a stopgap, you know? Or
yeah, maybe.
You know, there are teams out there like that who could use a goalie, and injuries happen, right? And I mean, what does everybody want to see out of this team this year? Are you happy if they don't make any moves?
Well, speaking of moves, and speaking of the Colorado Avalanche, who you are going to see, what do you think of Matt Duchene?
I think all 30 teams in the league should want Matt Duchene on their team. And if he is indeed available, and I am Lou Lamoriello, I go to Joe Sakic or whoever it is that runs the show over there, God knows who that is, which is part of the problem, and say you can build a deal involving anybody on my NHL roster except Morgan Riley. What do you think?
But if you're the Colorado Avalanche, that's number one guy you're looking at is Morgan Riley, right?
Yeah, and I just say if they say, we'll take Morgan Riley, I mean, I think about it. Like, yes, Morgan Riley looks like a really good young player right now. Matt Duchene's a Canadian Olympian. Like, this is like a pure number one center in the NHL who plays on a really crappy team that is poorly coached and poorly run from the executive suite and is kind of mired in a horrendous situation right now. You take him off that team and pluck him onto like pretty much any other team, and he's your number one center. And that's what this team in Toronto hasn't had since Matt Sundin.
Not that this team has like depth anywhere, really, but if you were looking at the young depth that's on this Maple Leafs team, would it not be on the forward ranks? Like, how much defense depth does it have? If you take away its best young defensive player,
it's not an ideal situation, Ben. I'm not saying I would do it, and I'm not saying that they should. I'm saying you got to look long and hard at that, because Matt Duchene is Matt Duchene. And yes, most of their depth is up front, or you could argue all of their depth is up front. I would trade JVR and Nazem Kadri and Joffrey Lupul and Dion Phaneuf and Jake Gardner right now for Matt Duchene.
I would too.
We call that the poo-poo platter.
Well, but would you though? Because isn't Nazem Kadri like a really great player who's set for a breakout?
Sure.
Isn't Dion Phaneuf your captain? Isn't JVR a guy who scored 30 goals a couple years ago and is like 6'4" and 220 pounds? And isn't Joffrey Lupul a 30-goal scorer if he can stay healthy? Like, how much – you just added an entire forward line and another defenseman to somebody's team, right? Like, I would do that.
I'm on board with that.
If I'm the Leafs. I don't know if I would do it if I was the Avs, but
– I would have an extreme difficulty trading Riley, though.
So would I, Jeff. 100%.
As valuable as number one centers are, there's a case that number one defensemen are just as valuable. And you look at the Cup winners the last 10 to 15 years –
I'm not advocating to trade Morgan Riley, not one bit. I'm just saying if they came to me and I was the GM and they said, would you do a one-for-one, I would have to think about it. That's all. Because Matt Duchene is a hell of a player. And he could be a lot better.
Yes, certainly if he was plucked out of that circumstance. Mentioned the Columbus Blue Jackets being rancid. They did beat the Pittsburgh Penguins 2-1 on a Friday night. Penguins are kind of an odd team. They've got all this offensive firepower, right? And they're winning games 2-1, 3-2. This is how they do things now, which is, I don't know, is that concerning? Is that actually a positive sign?
It's really weird because, like we were saying about the NBA, about how you have to have like a couple of superstars to win in that league, like that's almost the model that Pittsburgh is going after here with those top three forwards, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not really working out. So it's showing that, you know, you need depth in the NHL to win, and you can't do it with just a top heavy lineup. And this all goes back to scoring in general. I mean, the Pittsburgh Penguins can't score. If they can't score, nobody can in this league, right? So, you know, that's a whole other topic of conversation. That is, you know, being generated a lot by the coaching staff and general manager in this city as well, I think, as much to take away from the play on the ice that people are seeing.
The Detroit Red Wings moving on with life without Mike Babcock, and Damian Cox had a nice write-up on Sportsnet.ca a couple of weeks ago about how their possession numbers have totally changed without Mike Babcock. They're just a game over 500 now at 8-7-1, or maybe at 500, depending on how you evaluate 500 after losing 3-2 at home to the Sharks on Friday. This seems like a different team. And not necessarily a better team right now. Are we seeing the difference, first of all, in possession numbers of the Maple Leafs under Mike Babcock, but the departure of Mike Babcock? Did we maybe underplay that in Detroit?
I think this is a different team. It's a young team, or at least a younger team than Red Wings fans are used to seeing. And let's not forget Pavel Datsyuk only just came back last night. I mean, that guy's their best player. I think he will add a lot to the possession numbers and to the counting stats for that team. And they're working on some new things. I mean, there's a new guy in charge. And yes, well, the whole system of that franchise is kind of top down. Everybody does the same thing. Of course, Blashill is going to come in and tweak things a little bit, and everybody's going to have to get used to it. It's just the nature of having a new coach.
We mentioned the Maple Leafs can't score. There's a lot of teams, and the Penguins can't even score. If the Penguins can't even score, maybe we do have an issue here with scoring overall in the NHL. And maybe the conversation of expanding the nets does not take place if Mike Babcock doesn't speak out about it, because when he speaks, people in the world of hockey, they listen generally. In fact, Lou Lamoriello also with some ideas about creating offense in the NHL. We'll get to those in just a second, but it seems to be this rotating. Something needs to take place, and something it seems will take place for the 2016-2017 season. There's just too much conversation, and there's too little pushback from people about the scoring rate being just fine in the NHL. There's not too many people who are saying that. Now, is it expanding the nets? Is it decreasing the size of goalie pads? Is it a combination of both? I've been surprised, Jeff, in talking to as many, or I mean, I've talked to a few, but also reading comments from a few retired goalies of years past, and maybe it's easier when you're out of the game, but how many of them do say, yeah, the pads are way too big right now. Like, this is ridiculous what we're doing right now. There needs to be some regulating of the pad size, and you do that, and immediately you affect change in the game.
And that's exactly where I would start. The equipment now is crazy. You start with the catching gloves. Those before, back when the equipment was a lot smaller, it was like kind of like more like a baseball glove. Now,
you're like Troy Tulowitzki's disaster.
You ever hear about that glove?
No, never. Never when watching a playoff game broadcast by Fox.
Now you just need to get that thing in front of the puck. You don't need to catch as much as you need to block it. And just looking around the league, there's a guy like Ryan Miller. He's not a huge guy, but in those equipment, he looks gigantic. He looks like Ben Bishop. And I think that's where you start. The Nets is a tough change, and it's going to be a tough thing to get everyone to agree on. And it seems like that's too almost gimmicky. So I think equipment is where I would go number one, and I think that's the safest place to start.
I think too, Jeff, I mean, if a defenseman can stand in front of a 100-mile-an-hour slap shot and block it fearlessly,
yeah,
forwards as well, wearing the equipment that they're wearing, why do goalies have to have such massive pads? In this day and age, you can create a pad using the technology available that will keep you safe, make sure you're not open to more injuries, and be smaller. There's no doubt in my mind that that's the case. And if anything, you're going to allow the athleticism in your goalies, which in the past has been either absent or hidden by the size of pads, to shine. And wouldn't it be fun to see more guys actually having to use their reflexes more often to make spectacular saves like we used to see?
Don't we need like a dramatic change then in goalie pads? And how do we do it? It just seems like such a an intangible thing, changing the goalie pads. How do we do it? It just, I don't know. Do we go to the goalies, and doesn't it need to be drastic? Like, and also, where do we want scoring? Do we want it back to 80s levels where guys can be streaking down the wing and just, you know, inside the blue line, let go of a slap shot and it having a 50-50 shot of reaching the back of the net?
I'm not sure you would ever see it like that anyway, because the players are better now. Let's not forget, between like 1967 and, you know, the early 80s, the league expanded from like 6 to 22 teams in like a 15-year period, right? Like, the dilution of talent was extraordinary, and the top end versus the bottom end was insane, and that's not the case anymore. Also, goalies are more athletic, and this is a system-based league. This is not, you're not going to see the Wild West like that. And one thing about the pads is, when you say goalie pads, everybody automatically thinks of the big pads on their legs. Like, mm-hmm. I'm talking about things like streamlining the upper body pads and streamlining, like you said, Jeff, the glove, the blocker, things like that. Like,
but isn't that tougher to do? And I know you can have guidelines, but before every game, are you going to be measuring goalies? Like, how do you do it?
They used to do it with the pads. You know, now the league now the league measures all your pads before they're sent to you each season, right? And, you know, you could legislate the size of the sweaters, where these guys can't wear massive chest protectors underneath trimmer sweaters. Right?
But isn't there? There's just so many different aspects of changing the size of pads, whereas if you increase the size of the net, like, that's a simple fix. That's 2 inches either side.
Are you going to increase the size of the net in the AHL, the OHL, in AAA hockey, in house league hockey?
Sure.
You're going to all of a sudden have, like,
I'm going to buy stock
little 6-year
net
old kids, like, running around in these gigantic nets, right? Like, I just think, like, that's changing something that has been that way for a long, long time, and you don't need to mess with it. But what hasn't been this way for a long, long time is the size of the equipment.
You know what was one way for a long time was two-line passes. Those used to be outlawed.
And I get it.
The whole fabric of the game changed.
I get it, and I wouldn't be the first to say that, you know, the NHL has experimented almost its entire existence going back to the institution of the forward pass. And all of these rules that are generated are created to generate audience or offense were considered gimmicks at the time. But we've got six teams in the NHL right now that are averaging more than 3 goals a game.
Have you seen Anaheim's numbers?
Yes. No, I know. They're shooting like under 5% at 5-on-5.
Almost
it's
a goal
ridiculous.
A game.
Like, something needs to be done, because, like, if I could go to a Leafs game and watch a horrendous Leafs team play in a system, but they still scored like 3 goals and the game was 5-3 instead of 2-1, I'd be much more apt to go. I think people need to remember that.
Well, yeah, and I generally agree. The one thing I will say is that I kind of have a bit of a pushback when it comes to people saying you need goals, because there's a lot of scoreless
games. You need scoring
chances. Right. Scoring chances. Right? Are there not enough scoring chances? Are we looking at the wrong thing? Like, is there, because, and here's one of the points brought up by Lou Lamoriello in his suggestions as far as increasing scoring the game. How about the penalty killing team not being able to ice the puck? You can't ice the puck. You're killing a penalty. You fire it down the ice. Maybe once it's back in your zone and no change. Twice, it's another penalty, and it's a 5-on-3.
I think when you institute ideas like that, you're not solving the problem. You're just creating another, you're just kind of working around the fringes of the problem. You know what I mean?
Teams will just coach against that. And these teams today, they're so well coached, and the systems are designed to prevent shots. And I don't think that's a solution, really.
So it's entirely on the goalies.
And do you want...
No, that's just the first step.
Do you want your wins and losses and your team's chances at winning a Stanley Cup or even just making the playoffs to be wholly based on special teams?
Mm.
Like, you know, it's the same as if we went back to two-minute majors and you know, unlimited goals on a hooking penalty. Like, that's not how I want my NHL to be. I want my NHL to be about 5-on-5 speed and scoring chances and goals. And, like, when you get a penalty, you should be penalized, but the other team shouldn't get, like, a massive advantage every time.
Yeah, as far as the speed thing, I don't know how changing the goalie pads affects that. But I haven't seen two.
The goalies will be faster if they don't have as much padding.
You know what I've really enjoyed about the 3-on-3 overtime is how involved the goalies get in creating the offensive scoring chances and how quickly they figured it out that if you can become the fourth offensive player on the team, you can spring 2-on-1s, you can spring breakaways. That's been a great success. But I think it won't ever get stale, but I've heard the pushback. Hey, this is probably how you thought about shootouts when they were first instituted into the NHL. I don't know. I have a tough one with that. I think the shootout. Right, of course. But I probably did think the shootout was kind of cool at first because I hadn't seen the five possible moves that there are in a shootout. I have a tough time imagining myself getting sick of 3-on-3 overtime.
Because it's actual hockey. It's like settling a basketball game with a 3-point contest.
Some people think it's not actual hockey, though.
It's not as much, but it's still the nature of the game is just one less guy on the ice. It's not like a shootout where it's a skills competition, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a stodgy old man, I guess, but I don't mind ties. Yeah. I don't understand why every game has to end in a W and a loss.
I much prefer the tie to the 3-point game.
You know, like, I don't want you to, yeah. For sure, and I don't want to play for a tie, but I don't see, you want to know why 3-on-3 is a gimmick? Because if you get a penalty, it becomes a 4-on-3 situation.
Sure.
Like, why isn't it 3-on-2? Because then it's even worse, right? It's like, mm-hmm. You know, I just don't understand the need for wins every single game. I can be a fan and go home with a well-played tie and have just as much out of that game or get just as much out of that game as a shootout win.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside John Gregg and Jeff Simmons. It is still a talking point and kind of like almost a novelty story, although it happened a couple of days ago. It kind of put the Flint Firebirds on the map because a lot of people didn't realize that there was now an OHL team in Flint, Michigan. You're aware because their owner is crazy. And he's not the only crazy owner in sports, not necessarily professional sports, but Rolf Nilsson, and who among us wouldn't want more playing time for our sons, right? If we owned an OHL team, wouldn't we be maybe secretly pushing for more playing time for our sons? In this case, Hakan Nilsson's not that great, and John Gruden fought the idea of giving him more ice time. Eventually... he was fired. The entire team quit. Now everybody's been given extensions. They're rehired. All is good in Flint, Michigan. It's, I guess, a funny story on the outside looking in. Is it that funny if you play on that hockey team and you're a bit of a joke for a couple of days, John?
I don't think any of the players were a joke for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, kudos to them for doing what they did and for rallying around each other. Including the owner's kid. I mean, kudos to him for knowing that.
That guy's got a tough road ahead of him on the ice. How many guys are going to be giving him the gears?
I don't know. I mean, I think guys give guys the gears about absolutely everything on the ice every single day anyway. Right?
Not a lot of guys have ammunition now.
Yeah,
I mean, like legitimate things.
Yeah. I mean, he'll get over it. And I mean, he's not playing much anyway. You know, so
his future probably doesn't lie in hockey anyways.
No, I don't think so. And I bet you he would freely admit that. I mean, but granted, he's only a 17-year-old kid. I mean, who knows? With more playing time, he could get a lot better. Who knows? But I mean, he's a fringe OHLer at the moment. Whose dad wanted to see him, allegedly wanted to see him have more, get more ice time on his team. And, you know, the players stood up and fought against that. And the OHL walked in there and said, you cannot do this. This is not, you know, some junior B team in, you know, Paducah or whatever. This is the OHL, the number one developmental league, the NHL in the world. This is big business and we will not put up with it. And he was obviously put in his place. I mean, the coaches got extensions. Not only did they get their jobs back for this year, but they've got extensions. So
yeah.
Dave Branch went down there and laid the hammer down.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fascinating because hockey culture is so much do what you're told. Don't speak out against the norms. Don't say anything that's considered too crazy or too risky. These guys went completely against hockey culture and stood up against an owner for their coach. That's so out of left field from what I've seen around hockey almost my entire life. And
it's ballsy, right? Can you imagine, you're Will Bitten, who's got like 25 points and is leading that team in scoring, and it's his draft year, and he's going to walk in there and quit the team,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or, you know, Alex Nedeljkovic, who's like a second-round pick, and he's their number one goalie, and he's going to go in there and quit the team. I mean, he might have a bit more leverage because he's already got an NHL parent club, right? But still, I mean, good on these kids. And, it was Gare Joyce in our office the other day who said, if I'm an OHL GM, I'm looking to trade for that captain. Because, damn, did he ever do a good job of rallying the guys and showing some character.
Yeah, it's like a Rudy situation, right?
Except it actually happened.
Hey, Rudy happened! Don't do that.
They didn't put all the jerseys on the coach's desk?
Don't do that.
Guys, sorry. I don't want to break anybody's
Stop
heart here.
That.
But
you're ruining my favorite movie.
All right, we better break here before John ruins more of our childhood memories. When we return, speaking of football, we'll get into the week that is already partially with the Thursday nighter and the Buffalo Bills with another big in-division victory, this time over the New York Football Jets. Also a big divisional game coming up Sunday night with the Seahawks and Arizona Cardinals, and I'm sure Jeff Simmons has a thought or two about how the Cardinals are just going to beat up on the Seahawks because they're not as good this year. Stay tuned for that and that unlikely take. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and John Gregg at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dan Robson.
Future has arrived in Toronto, though not in the place that most Leaf fans would like to see it. Down the road from the Air Canada Centre, the hope of a franchise is staked on a group of kids who at first glance could pass for a boy band. The baby faces of the Toronto Marlies are being meticulously monitored and developed, learning a brand of hockey that the Leafs organization expects to reverse nearly five decades of misfortune. At sparsely attended Marlies games, Lou Lamoriello sits high above in a box watching over his prospects. Mike Babcock checks in with the team a couple of times a week. If the Leafs aren't playing, you might find him sitting in the stands at Rico. This is where the real hope lies. But regardless of how bad things get with the Leafs, the team's brass has taken a vow of patience with their prized prospects. And because it's unlikely you'll see them in a Leafs sweater anytime soon, we spent some time at the farm with some of the kids who carry the most expectation, William Nylander, Kasperi Kapanen, and Connor Brown, to find out what the future in Toronto really looks like.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue, or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and John Gregg. The NFL into week 10 now. Yeah, week 10. That's kind of crazy. We are mid-November, so I guess that makes sense. The Buffalo Bills now back over 500. A couple of huge divisional wins. One against the Miami Dolphins, who are all but done, it seems. And then Rex Ryan returning to the Meadowlands and enjoyed beating the Jets very much, seemingly, even though he underplayed it a little bit until the game was completed, and then it exploded with joy. Bills win that one 22-17. Tyrod Taylor returns under center, and they're a different team, not unlike the Raptors with Damari Carroll. Jeff, is this Bills team finally good enough to make the playoffs in an AFC that is all done as far as division winners, seemingly, and there's, what, four or five teams battling for two wildcard spots?
They have to stay healthy, and that's been their issue all year. How often have they had Taylor, McCoy, Watkins on the field at the same time?
Week one. Did they have week one?
I think it was week one, and they destroyed the Colts.
Yeah.
And when E.J. Manuel came in, they just became such a dysfunctional offense.
Oh, he's done. Yeah, like his future as an NFL quarterback seems to be complete.
Yeah, he's got nothing. And the things he doesn't do well, you can't teach.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have all these guys back, and you saw what Watkins did against Miami the week before, Watkins looked pretty good going up against Revis this week, and he had some chances to make some really big plays, and he ran some really good routes, and McCoy kind of looked like that back that they kind of thought they were getting, and the guy who was from Philadelphia, and they got that good rookie, Carlos Williams. That's a dangerous
offense. He scores a touchdown every time he takes the field.
Yeah. So when these guys are all healthy and you combine it with that defense, that's a pretty good team.
And I'm a Rex Ryan guy. I like Rex Ryan. I know he's a bit of a diva when it comes to head coaches, and he likes to stir the pot with the IKNM Pauly thing and the fact that he was a captain for that game, which was hilarious. I like, you know, being in this industry, I like the guys that help make news, and Rex Ryan's certainly one of those guys, and he is very vineable, which is good as well in this day and age.
It's nice when you have a mediocre football team, but an outgoing coach who can create headlines and drive a media cycle for you.
Sure, and maybe they are slightly better than mediocre, although John Gregg is a Bills hater for whatever reason.
I've talked about it on this show before, so I won't bore everybody again.
All right, okay. The game of the week, and there are a bunch of duds this week, as there seemingly are every week, because there's just not a lot of good teams. Actually, Vikings-Raiders Raiders is a pretty good game. Patriots-Giants, also a good game. But the Sunday nighter is a beauty. And it used to be in that division that Seahawks-Niners was the must-see attraction, but then the Niners falling on hard times, obviously. They're no longer in the discussion. But the Seahawks are just 4-4 after a Super Bowl appearance in what should have been probably a Super Bowl victory over the New England Patriots. And they still have, I imagine, hopes of winning that division. But to do it, Jeff, they're going to need a win at home against the Arizona Cardinals, who were the darlings of the NFL a few weeks ago. Now they've since lost twice, and it took until the final moments to beat the Ravens. But this seemingly is pretty good matchup, and one that I think, well, naturally, when you look at the standings, the Seahawks are the more desperate club.
Yeah, this game really says a lot about both teams because Arizona, by every measure you look, are a better team than Seattle. Every advanced stat, every basic stat will tell you that. The eye test will tell you that. They're deeper. They got more weapons. But they haven't beaten anyone. And their two losses came against the only quality teams they've played, and one of them was Pittsburgh without Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah, that's tough.
They lost to Landry Jones. They lost to St. Louis. And the rest of the games came against cupcakes. And Seattle, in the same measure, they haven't beaten anyone either. All their wins came against bad teams. So this will tell you whether Arizona is legit. If they can go into Seattle, probably the hardest place to play in the league, that will seal a division that's three games with a game in with the tiebreaker there. But if Seattle can get back and play, they're a great home team, and they win this game, they're back in this thing. And as bad as they've looked in the first half, we don't know what they are right now. They're one game back with the tiebreaker. This whole thing's wide open again.
Well, what are they right now, the Seattle Seahawks? Because I mentioned it wasn't that long ago we were talking about this team being in the Super Bowl against the New England Patriots, and they haven't looked like a Super Bowl-type team through eight games and 9 weeks of this NFL season. What are they?
Everyone's still trying to figure it out because at times their defense looked great. In their last two games that they've won, they haven't allowed a touchdown. but those games came against Matt Cassel and Colin Kaepernick. And on offense, they're not functioning as well as they thought because their offensive line has regressed to the point where it's probably the worst in the league. Russell Wilson has taken more sacks than any other quarterback, and he's getting hit at a ridiculous rate. And Marshawn Lynch, as a result, hasn't been able to get going on the ground. And Jimmy Graham hasn't been able to get comfortable. He's been a little bit better, so they don't really have an identity on offense right now. And the defensive depth isn't what it was. They've been kind of torn apart in free agency, and they've been haven't been able to draft those players. And so they're still kind of they're a 500 team. Their record is kind of what they are on paper right now.
And that's an amazing stat that Russell Wilson has been sacked more than anybody else in the league, because that's what he's being known for, right? His ability to escape trouble and to roll out and to make things happen with his legs. And, you know, as you said, it's the offensive line is just decimated there, right?
And if it wasn't for a guy like Wilson, that number would be much higher. Yeah. That's the scary part. There are plays he makes that he just runs around and creates. And a lot of their offense this year has been just freelancing, creating him running around and hoping someone gets open on like a just a fluke play.
The Patriots, one of those unbeaten teams. They're 8-0, as mentioned. They're in the Meadowlands taking on the Giants in one of the late afternoon games. And if ever there was a team that's not going to be afraid of an 8-0 New England Patriots, it's the New York Football Giants, who have beaten them in a couple of Super Bowls and foiled already one perfect season. I tend to think the Giants are much better than their 5-4 record shows, although they've been inconsistent. But a couple of wins have been snatched away with poor clock management. They have JPP back, and look, maybe not quite to his former self, but at least a valuable contributor on the defensive line. And the Patriots, for all their offensive prowess, they've been a little bit susceptible defensively. Is this the week that we see the Patriots lose?
It just seems to me like it's going to be one of those games that's either like 37-35 down to the end, field goal wins it, or, you know, 35-3, Patriots walk. You know, like I don't know what to make of the Giants other than the fact that they're maddeningly inconsistent on a week-to-week basis, and you just don't know what you're going to get.
Go ahead.
Part of the reason the Giants gave them trouble, at least in those two Super Bowls in the past, they had that dominant pass rush that came from all over the field, and they don't have that anymore. Pierre-Paul is just coming back, and outside of him, there's not much there. And that was the way they stopped Brady. They got in his face, and they don't have that anymore, and then their coverage has been leaky as a result, and they're just a bad defense.
It makes for fun football.
Yeah.
We saw that against New Orleans, right?
Exactly.
But, I mean, it doesn't make for long-term winning football.
Not against the Patriots.
Got about a minute and a half to go here, guys, so I'll end it on the question that John Gregg just raised in the break. Of the good teams, who's the worst of them? And I guess we can say that the Patriots naturally are a good team. The Bengals in there as well. Broncos at 7-1. And in the NFC, the Panthers obviously at 8-0. Cardinals, a good team. I guess you got to put the Falcons in. People think are a good team, even though they're tied with the Minnesota Vikings. Who among those is the worst team?
This is a surprising one, but I would go with the Packers, and they've appeared to be kind of leaky lately. Outside of the receivers aren't getting open. Jordy Nelson is out for the season, and they've really missed him as that James Jones thing's kind of come down to earth, and they're not a great defensive team. They're not running the ball. Eddie Lacy's been benched, and their offensive line is letting Rodgers get hit too much, and you saw against Carolina and Denver, these guys were kind of exposed, and they got beaten down in both games. And they came back a little at the end in the fourth quarter, but they're fighting on the sidelines. I think they're not as good as we once thought they were.
Yeah, certainly the shine's been worn off, and it started with the shellacking at the hands of the Denver Broncos. And next week, a real big divisional matchup as they head to Minnesota to take on the Vikings, both teams 6-2 at this point, and the Packers looking to get back atop that division. That'll do it. Another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live for John Gregg and Jeff Simmons. I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.